for just about a minute or two.
Morning.
Morning, Jim.
How are you? I'm well. How are you?
Good. Feel much better. A little bit of cough. But I'll take that if that's all I'm getting this year.
Oh, no, you too. I've been sick all week.
Yeah, everybody I'm speaking to. It's just like a week and a half thing. That's all. I guess the body needs it to clear out. So we're going to pick up from where we left off in Cohelis. We're up to 7:25. I'll just wait till everybody logs on.
Hey, Rabbi.
Hey, Doug. How are you? How was your trip?
It was good.
Good.
Long journey, but good trip.
How far is Manila by plane?
Total travel time, I figured door to door was, depending on which direction you went, was somewhere between about 20 and 25 hours.
Wow. And I guess
about 16 to 18 of that in the air.
Wow.
Somewhere along that line. Actually, well, coming back, probably the total air time was more like 13. How are you feeling?
Much better, thank you.
Good.
Yeah, pretty much back to myself. It was like hard to
talk. Oh, that's great.
Yeah, last week I had it was just like, you know, the peak, I guess, of chest cold. And I mean, I felt fine. It wasn't like, you know, feverish, no body aches, thank God. So I was able to function, just, you know, talking was a problem. It was funny. I was in shul in the temple last week, so we have a learning group after the prayers in the morning. We finish at about 9:30, and so I was learning with a few regular friends, and my one friend was taking advantage of the fact that I couldn't talk, and he kept on pushing his point forward, and knowing that I couldn't respond. So it was quite humorous, but I think I retaliated this week. Yeah, they're just waiting for that opportunity.
Yeah.
One thing I had, you know, if you want, maybe you'll help out. I had somebody who I knew a long time ago. My sense is that he's not observant now, but he had a lot of these attacks on proving Sinai and proving the Jewish history and on these different arguments. And he pretty much got these arguments from his site. And I'm not sure if it's popular or whatnot, but it's just funny to just see, like, the people who attack Torah, they throw you like a barrage of arguments, the cheapest arguments they can give you. But they feel if they give enough arguments, you know, it's like throwing enough stuff at the wall, something's going to stick. So you look for the arguments, and they're just as if the person is so fluent in history and archaeology and writing styles and literature, because they give all these arguments about, oh, this part of the Torah doesn't have the same writing style as that, so how can it be one author? Therefore, it can't be God. Or you have no remains of the 40 years of the Jews in the desert, so therefore, that can't be true. And, you know, so on and so forth. So, yeah, I wrote back. I put it in the Jewish Times this week on the cover. So we'll see what he says back. But the one big mistake he's making is, in terms of, you know, lacking any type of artifacts or anything in the desert. So first of all, who knows they're looking in the right spot? Even if they are, so the Jews didn't stay, they weren't stationary. And there was no, like, structures that they made in terms of cities to be found. And on top of that, the whole concept of trying to lodge a rejection of a history because you haven't found anything, well, that really, you have to think about that. Is the lack of evidence something which can be used as a proof or just a question? So they use it as they want to say, oh, that's proof. It could have happened. Jews, if they were there, they would have found something. But maybe they didn't find it yet. I mean, simply, when you don't have anything, that's just what it is. It's a lack. It's a negative. So to say, well, since I have nothing here in this location, so therefore it must be that they weren't here. But again, having a lack of evidence, you can't make a statement about that. You can just say, right now you don't have something. But that doesn't reject the history, certainly if that's the only history. Like I asked him also, where's the, if you tell me this is not the truth, and all these stories didn't take place, and Egypt, and so on and so forth, and the miracles, and the Exodus, so why is it that today we don't have what he would claim to be the accurate story? We only have this one false story. Is it possible then that you can have a true history of an entire people completely obliterated and replaced by the entire population by a fabricated story? You think it's possible to do that? Or would you say that, no, some people are not going to give up what they know is true, passed down, and they're going to hold on to it? At least, the worst case scenario, you'll have two stories. You won't have the complete replacement of the true story with a fabrication. So you see my argument to him?
Yeah.
I mean, how could that be? You're going to tell me that that ever happened, that you could replace a real history? Or just the opposite's going to happen. People who know the history, they'll pass it down, and they're not going to just give it up because somebody comes along and says that your history is really wrong. Certainly, if the history started out, and, you know, Moses is telling the people, don't forget what your eyes saw. A story like that would never be accepted. If I go to people today and tell them, don't forget what your eyes saw, that there were, you know, spaceships in the George Washington Bridge today. Well, if they weren't there, there's no way they're going to replace what they know really took place that day. They went to the zoo with their kids that day. There was no spaceships or whatever it was they were doing that day. They're not going to forfeit and, you know, abandon and do it in unison. I mean, it's just a ridiculous. It's absurd. But people actually have this opinion. But I think it really comes from the place that they want to reject Torah, and they're looking for any type of a shred that, you know, that they can. That's really where I think it comes from. And that's why they can have a barrage of arguments, because they feel, oh, look at all those arguments. They feel that there's safety in numbers. Same phenomena. A lot of people do something, or if I throw a lot of arguments at you. So it's important just to see the method, not just to respond to what their claims are. They really become exposed as completely foolish. But then they get angry, and they start taking attacks, and that's what took place already. The response was, oh, I thought I was expecting a lot more from you, this and that. It's just so transparent, it's amazing. But it's a good exercise in terms of rehearsing the truth. That much I can gain from it. Okay, so we have everybody on. I guess it's not a fair question for the people who can't respond, right? Cal's here with us?
Yes, I'm here. Good morning.
Okay, Rivka? Not yet, okay. Jim's here. Francesca? Josh? Veronica? So maybe we should start. It's still a little late, right? It's 11:20 I have here. Is that right?
Yeah, I think that's... we, in fact, got close to 11:30.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Oh, no. I'm sorry. I'm reading the wrong... reading the wrong thing.
Okay, so where we are now is... let's see where we are now. We're in... and the sound is good?
Yes,
great.
Okay, good. Okay. So...
Rabbi?
Yes?
I'm here.
Hi, how are you?
I was here. Yeah, I couldn't answer before. I'm sorry.
No
Thank
problem.
You. Good morning. Everybody is well.
Okay. Now we can start. Rip is here. Now we're ready.
I'm here. I was here. I couldn't answer before. I'm sorry. Thank you.
Good morning. Hey, just, Rip, could turn off the speaker on your computer because you get your feedback. If you're on the phone, you don't need the speaker on the computer, so... If you could, you know, turn off the volume.
Okay.
Unless you want me to hear you twice. I'm happy hearing you twice. I just don't think it's needed. Okay. Here we go. So, up to this point, if you review, so King Solomon was talking the last few verses about a person shouldn't be too righteous, shouldn't be too wicked. He, in terms of grabbing onto the right life, he's not becoming emotionally attached to one thing, but he realizes that there's a time and place for everything, as he stated earlier in chapter 3. And when he says in verse 18 that a person should grab onto this and also not let go of that, it means that both in terms of a life of wisdom, but not to the point that he becomes like a zealot, and he abandons his pursuit for a livelihood because he thinks it's so self-righteous to be involved in the higher, you know, spheres of wisdom. Nope, you've got to make a living. God made you with a stomach. You have to feed that stomach. You have to be practical. You need shelter. So he talks about the different attitudes of the path that a person should choose. And, but again, you keep in mind, he's talking about in terms of the virtues, in terms of the person, foolishness, wickedness, wisdom, cunning, whatever is the attitude, the virtue, the different faculties of the psyche, and what's the balance, what's the right approach. So we're continuing on that, and he talks about, and even though he says that wisdom is something which you have to marry with a practical livelihood, you have to pursue, it's also good psychologically. The rabbis say in Pirkei Avos that Torah study with a worldly pursuit, meaning having a job, it helps a person to forget sin, because sin comes about, like, you know, they say idle hands is, the devil worship, something like that. It's like a Christian thing. But sometimes even a person is not in the Jewish fold can come across with the truth. And like Maimonides says, you learn the truth from anybody. So it says idle hands is devil worship. It means to say that the inactivity in terms of pursuing the sense of accomplishment, so that when that's not satisfied, so those energies are frustrated. Because there's one area, wisdom, that can be satisfied when you're learning. But then there's also other parts to us. That's what God created the human psyche with, the sense of accomplishment. And all these different, these myriads, these dozens and dozens of emotions and strivings, they're there for a reason. So there has to be a correct balance. But despite all that, he says in 7:19, that still wisdom lights up. It strengthens the wise person. And it's stronger than the 10 powerful people. Just to let you know that wisdom still is the highest. That should be what you recognize as being the most superior virtue. Okay, then he goes on, and he talks about in 20, I'm just reading back because I want you to see how the next area is going to be couched in this section. It's important to see the context and to see that it helps a lot in terms of understanding where he's going. Okay. And he says that no man is righteous in land that does good and never sins, in order to show you. And he gives you now from an example, because he first told you the theory that you should hold on to 18, that you should grab onto this. It's good that you should grab onto this. And also from that, don't let go. Meaning to say, grab onto the lack of wisdom, but don't let go of a pursuit of a livelihood. So that's in terms of theory. But then he shows you practically in 20 that look around, you'll see that there's no person who's completely righteous. To show you that he had the attempt at a person to try to be this self-righteous person and just to be involved in good, that he's never going to stumble, that's not a possibility anyway. So he's giving you an argument from practicality too. Then he talks about the social, that you shouldn't worry about if you hear your workers that are saying something against you. That's what he says in 21. To all these matters that they speak, don't give heart to it. That you shouldn't listen to your own workers, the ones that really you've benefited most, and they're going to now curse you. So don't give heart to that, because why? The next verse. Because there are many times, many times, in your own heart, that you also cursed other people. So he talks about cursing over here, because that's really one of the strongest attitudes. And we talked about how solitary confinement is the worst punishment in prison, because the need for the social interaction is the strongest. So that's what he talks about this right at the outset, in terms of what attitudes to hold on to, what is of the strongest, but now how to deal with each one. So he's talking internally, how should a person be managing their own psyche and their workings? What should they give value to? What should be the energy that they give to each? Is it a good thing to have this image of yourself as being completely righteous? No, practically it can't even take place. So you see, he's trying to guide the person on this path. And he says in 23 that all this I've explored, I've analyzed, and I said I'll become wise, but this is too distant for me. It's still something which, to gain all the knowledge, even though it's an act of exploration that I'm trying to do here, I'm trying to pursue, nonetheless, to try to look at this as something which is an egotistical objective, where I'm now going to get all the knowledge. I saw that it's, and I said to myself, I will become wise. You see that in 20 and 23? Meaning the ego became part of the pursuit now for the wisdom. So he saw that that became involved, but that can't be satisfied, because it is too far. It's too far for me. Excuse me one second. See this here. You see, he says at the end, he says that it's distant from me. That means to say that when the self was involved, so there was a frustration. So pursuit of wisdom is not, the self can't be part of the picture. You're looking at wisdom externally, and that's really where the person is happiest. When they're, and we talked about this, I think, a week or two ago, that the person's happiest when, and Rabbi Chait mentioned this, when the person has an external pursuit, something which captivates them, it draws their interest, and they're exploring outside themselves. They're not, the self is not the center, because that's a dead end, and that'll become very frustrating. Because what's the person going to do if he just wants to be the center of attention? So the applause that people can give you is going to be short-lived, because they have their own pursuits. They can't be clapping for you all the time. You can't be the honoree at a dinner all the time. So, and just carrying around an image of yourself that you think is so grandiose, it'll be completely frustrated, because you see that people don't pay attention to you. Even the biggest movie stars, they have their 15 minutes of fame, and that's it. So that's going to be completely frustrating. But that shouldn't be the reason why you do it. It should be the reason why we pursue lives where we're looking at things outside of ourselves, is because that's how we're designed to be happy. When our energy can keep on moving forward, and it doesn't hit a dead end, and we find another, vault of wisdom in a new area that we explore, and something opens up, and then we enjoy that idea. And then that leads us to another question. So that type of a flow of energy, which doesn't hit a wall, is really what the experience of happiness is, where the energy is not frustrated. And that can only be when you're pursuing something which is endless. So that's God's wisdom. And whatever the area is, whether it's the natural world, whether it's the world of Torah, neither one. So he saw that. He's always frustrated when the ego became part of it. But then he says in 24 that, well, to really understand the human being, and really going back to the beginning, and Doug, you had given a very good answer. That's where you really see how you can, when something's being created, so that's when you can see the components of something. And that's when you can have a greater understanding. If I just look at the chair, so I see a finished product. I don't see the tree. I don't see the saws that were involved. I don't see the thread that was put onto the poles that they screwed into the armrests. But if I see the beginning, the working of something, now I understand the creation and how it's assembled. And what's a stronger part of the chair, what's not. So King Solomon had that understanding. But then he said, it's too far off, too distant. Right? He says, Ibn Ezra says, that which was is very far off, it's very distant. So it's a deep science, plus the fact that it's far in the past, that's why he uses the word twice. It's deep, deep. You see, he repeats that. Okay, so now what was his choice to do in terms of understanding the human condition better? So now he says, and this is the last verse that we did, we'll review it and now we'll go into it more. 25. I returned myself and my heart to know and to explore and to seek out wisdom and calculations, and to know also the wickedness of foolishness and the folly of just being mad, of being uncontrolled, just running for, a person who's just like, frivolity. So you see what he's doing now is that beforehand he was talking about independent aspects of the psyche. Wisdom or wickedness. Justice. Now he says, and according to Ibn Ezra, read, he says, I return now my attention and my thoughts in my heart to know if I join together wisdom and calculation and understanding creation and all the elements, like Sforno says, together with the wickedness of foolishness. I mean, if I indulge in both aspects, the intelligent part of the human psyche, as well as the emotions. And then he says, I found nothing more bitter. And then he says, I found. And what was his result? He says, and I found something more bitter than death was the woman. That she is like an entrap, she entraps. And her heart is like a net, is like nets. And her hands are like, her arms are like chains. It's better before God that one should escape from her. But the sinner will be entrapped by her. Okay. So, of course, we have to understand what he means, because God created woman. So he can't be saying that woman is a negative. So it has to mean something else. So you look right away, and Ibn Ezra answers the problem. And he says, what did I find more bitter than death? The desire, the sexual desire. And he says as follows. He says, what did I find? Hacheshek, meaning the desire. So, Ya'ir Eine Chachamim, Ya'aver Eine Chachamim, because this desire, the sexual drive, is something which blinds the eyes of even the wise people. And it confuses the thoughts. And that's actually a verse from the Torah, I believe twice in the Torah. It talks, when it talks about a bribe, it says that the judges shouldn't take a bribe because they blind the eyes of the wise and they confuse the words of the righteous. Now that alone is a very nice idea. Why those two things? What does it mean that it blinds what does it mean that a bribe? And we'll come back to what it means over here in terms of the sexual, and why that specifically he brings that out over here. But clearly, he's talking about it's not the woman, it's the drive. And the truth is, a person can't blame a woman, even if it was a woman, because the person's making a decision whether he wants to subject himself to a life where he's running after lusts or not. So it's really his own. Okay. And Chaim, you're asking, that he's only discussing the temptation of a man, how does the verse apply to temptations to a woman? I would say it's the same. The same thing. Because the drive is equally strong in both. But you only have to use one example. Okay. Now, you see what he wanted to do, though, is that he wanted to explore, so he couldn't explore what was in the past, he said. That which was distant in it, and when God first created man, so that's too far off. It was very difficult. So he used the self. You see what he says? And I returned myself in my heart. So there's him, and there's also his heart. You could say he's saying that the him, meaning if I say that I returned myself, so the me is really the highest part of me. What is the thing which makes the decisions? Now, I can make decisions based on intelligence, or I can make decisions based on what the emotional pull is. So there's the me in the middle, what they call the ego, the part of the person that decides. So a person who spends his years in intelligence and sees the truth, so he's naturally drawn to the truth, and he makes decisions based on the truth. And he may still feel the pull of the emotions, but he quickly overcomes them, and then if he does it right at the beginning of the battle, so then they will lose their power. If he lets them go and he lets the urges build up, so they're going to overtake him at the end of the battle. If you take a look at the Sforno in Genesis, where it talks about God gives the punishment to the snake, he says, man will conquer you by stepping on your head, but you'll conquer man by biting him at the heel. So if you want to take a look at that, you'll see that's exactly what we're discussing. That's where I got it from, too. That stepping on a snake is a parallel to the head. Step on the instincts at the head of the battle, at the beginning of when they first try to attack you. But if you don't, and if you let the emotions go and you give in to them, so at the heel of the battle, the snake will get you. That's what means the snake bites you at the heel. That the instincts will overtake man if he allows the emotions to swell up inside of him. But if he controls himself at the beginning, at the onslaught of the emotional urges, that's where man has the strongest hand. He's got the upper hand at that point. Okay, so he said that now he's going to return himself and his heart, and he's going to explore and see how the workings, if he both joins the intelligent part of himself and the emotional part, what will happen if I give in to both? See, he is doing an exploration on the self, and is using himself as the model. So he's basically the observer and the subject at the same time. I remember Rabbi Shay talking about Kohelis years ago, and he said that only King Solomon was the one that really can do this. He had that level. And remember, he was the one that was given miraculous wisdom at 12 years old when he took over the throne from King David. Okay. Now, he said a couple of things. He said he wants to acquire wisdom. We're in the beginning of 25. And then to explore. Then he's going to now seek out further how it works. And he's going to request and to try to come to conclusions. That's why I have a few terms here. To know, to start off with what he knows. What do I know about the human psyche, the human condition? And to explore it and to see how the emotions interact with the intelligence, which is a very abstract pursuit, but you have to be so objective because you're exploring yourself as you're acting. And to seek out answers. And he wanted to get to arrive at wisdom and calculation. So how is it that the interactions work? And also to see the wickedness of foolishness, to see to understand how damaging a foolish life can be. And then the futility or the foolishness, the person who just lives his life, happy-go-lucky, or just giving into all the emotions. Sforno says an interesting thing here. He says, he wants us to understand the intent of God in all of creation. And then he says also the reasoning of the number, the precise limited number of existences that God created. Plants, animals, so on and so forth. Inasmuch that if man would want to add on to them, then he couldn't. And we see this that when you try to crossbreed things, the product of what's crossbred cannot produce anymore. So it's a dead end when you try to create a new species. All right, separate point. He also says further, interesting, he wanted to understand the wickedness of foolishness of the snake, of the primordial snake. How could it be that it was so cunning, but it did not fear any type of punishment? How could it be that there was such a phenomenon that on the one hand you had the snake that was in it had such cunning, but that very cunning quality could not be shrewd enough to be fearful of the punishment that it would get for beguiling the woman. So you see that he recognizes that certain faculties can be limited to their own scope of function. Cunningness is all it has is the ability to be cunning. It doesn't have a self-reflective quality of guilt. That's a completely different compartment to the person. So he's showing you that it's just like an instinct, really. The instincts are just driving for satisfaction. Whether it's revenge, whether it's sexual, whether it's the appetitive. So they have their own sphere of function, and that's it. So King Solomon saw this. And he saw that they have their independent function, and they can't function outside of that. It's really the person that is the self that has to choose. While I know that there's a certain satisfaction in getting revenge and from a person who wronged me, at the same time, he's got to bring the intellect in and see how damaging that could be to the soul and see how futile that is, and it's a waste of his energy because it's only a person who's insecure that needs to make things, you know, even again in his own mind. He feels less on the, you know, lowered in self-esteem when he was rejected by somebody. But in fact, nothing in reality was affected when a person calls you a name. So that's purely an egotistical drive. It does nothing. And reality is not going to be fixed, quote-unquote, if you get back at him. It really just stoops to the level of where you feel that the world of the social, in your own mind, is more important than spending time in pursuit of wisdom, of truth. But it's only the person. That part of us, we call the ego, that makes the decisions, the decisive factor. That's what we have to select from between the emotions and between the intellect. So what King Solomon is saying, according to Sforno here, he says it's an amazing thing, but it's a truth that the snake was very cunning, but that cunning did not help in terms of preventing sin, because fear of sin is not a process of the cunning faculty. In its raw, independent form, the cunning faculty of the person just seeks to manipulate and to be shrewd, but doesn't have anything else. That's its own function. And he says further, he says, and how could it be that the woman, with her own admission of the sin, and she wasn't afraid of punishment either, that she even said, she verbalized to the snake that if we eat from this, and then, you know, we're going to be killed. But then what he says is, he finds, now we'll get back to the point about, you know, taking a bribe and the sexual. So he said what he found, umosa, because you see the verse 26 starts off with and. That means, but now that I went to explore these areas, what did I find was most damaging? It was to be drawn in by the sexual. And he says this blinds even the eyes of the wise people, and it confuses the words of the righteous, the thoughts. Ibn Ezra says. Sforno says that this causes a person to be destroyed. He has eternal destruction because once he caves into the sexual and he's giving to that, it's a very strong area. That's why he talks about it as being as if it's as if the woman is chaining the person or she has nets, because it's such a strong drive, and the more a person gives into it, the greater the craving becomes. Okay. And that's why he says at the end that the sinner will be trapped by her. Because he's not going after a life of wisdom, he's going after a life of the sexual, of the lusts. But you see what he's saying is interesting, is that he's trying to show you how the emotions, these two worlds that we have inside of each one of us, the intelligence and the emotions, even though they're independent and they can function with their own, you know, they're constantly unrelenting, pushing towards each faculty, whether it's revenge, whether it's the sexual, whether it's food, whether it's ego, fame, whatever it is, each one is constantly pushing, unless the person uses intelligence to unravel them and to see how they work and to see their plus and their minus, as that's what he's going to do in the next verse. Of the one comment said that 21, verse 20, excuse me, verse 27, which is the next verse, he says, compare one to the other to find out the calculation, meaning that is going to be an approach in terms of understanding and controlling the emotions. You'll be able to see how they affect. But you see that if a person gives it a lot into one area, it doesn't just leave the intelligence alone. He says that this could now confuse the wisdom of the person. It crosses over to the other side. So it's not just that if you give in, you just had an isolated activity of indulgence. But if a person gives in, so what happened is now the craving for that will cause a person to compromise his thought. He'll value that more, that he won't pay attention to a rational explanation, and he'll even do, and he'll go to the point where he'll rationalize adultery. He'll rationalize things that can destroy his life because he's not thinking clear anymore. He's trying to show you that this is that's why it's something which is worse than death. But death is just the end of your physical. We have to answer, why is it worse than death? Because death is merely the end of your physical existence. But if a person gives in to the drives to the point where he compromises his thinking, so like Sforno says, that terminates his soul. That's not just physical death. That's spiritual death. And that's why we see in the Torah, God says in the Torah, that if a person is a judge and he takes a bribe, so what will happen is that the bribe, the desire for money, is going to confuse two things. Eyes, what are the eyes? The eyes are where a person perceives, where he takes in the facts in the case. And the thoughts, that's the calculation of the case in terms of deciding a verdict. So there's two parts to the judge's role. There's the perception, and then there's the deliberation. And if a person takes a bribe, so that favoring of the person is going to confuse those processes. He's not going to look at things so objectively anymore in terms of perceiving what are the facts of the case. And he's also, he's going to lean more towards favoring the guy that gave him the money. Because it's not simply that you're involved in emotion and there's nothing to it in terms of it doesn't affect the other side. It does. It greatly affects the other side, meaning it affects the intelligence of the person.
Rabbi?
Yes.
Just curious, in verse number 26 about the woman, I was wondering from the woman's perspective, could you use the verse in there about don't put a stumbling block in front of a blind man? Like as if a man's emotions like that causes him to be blind and the woman who ensnares him like that, she's putting a stumbling block?
It could be. I mean, it could also be that he's referring to as well, because Eve was the one that beguiled Adam. So it could be he's also pointing to the fact that there is this type of a control. That's why you see, what was the curse of Eve? Was that she would have to, her sexual desire would be left up to the husband. She won't be as brazen as a man in terms of asking for it. She has a certain amount of embarrassment. And she'll have to cleave to him for it. Because there was a certain amount of domination that she expressed in terms of making him sin and bringing and dominating him and beguiling him to eat. So that was tempered a bit. See, that was one of the responses. Chaim, you're saying that man has the ability to self-train himself not to want satisfaction by instilling a conditioned reflex not to want. Right. That's true. The more you distance yourself from a desire, the less pull it has on you. That's actually a statement of the rabbis. They're talking about the sexual drive, and they say there's a small limb in man. If he feeds it, it gets hungry. If he starves it, it gets full. That means if you feed a desire, it's going to aggravate it and desire more. If you starve a desire, it gets used to having less, and the drive is less. And that allows you to be more involved in the wisdom in the life of making intelligent decisions without being compelled by an emotion.
Rabbi.
Yes, sir.
So, it strikes me that there's a little bit of a strange contradiction here, because so God created man with a sexual drive, and in the context of the halakhic bounds in which Jews and Gentiles live, within marriage context and such, as long as one's not in violation of halakha, one can engage in sexual relations. Yet the verse seems to be saying, well, yeah, but don't go down that road, because that's not such a good thing, because you get ensnared and pulled into all kinds of difficulties. On the other hand, that could lead a person to say, well, the best thing then is to completely abstain from doing that, except that that creates all kinds of difficulties too. And so, I mean, it seems like the ideal approach would be some sort of balance in there, but the verse doesn't seem to be getting at that. Or is the verse getting at not the fact that a person has sexual relations, but that that becomes like the main drive in his life?
Exactly. Meaning the desire, the drive, is what he's saying, even Ezra. Let's see. Yeah, I think one verse actually was referring to, it doesn't even mean a woman, it means a heretic. But going along this drive here, just, the drive being the sexual, so you have to say that it's the excess, because it's God's will that it exists. So there has to be a measure of acceptance of acceptable engagement in that. Whereas it's the one who, since it has a very satisfying sensation, so typically a person is going to function like an animal unless he has a guide, unless he is recognizing that there's something greater than that in life, and he sees the short-lived aspect of it. And he has to wonder why it is like that. Why didn't God make the sexual satisfaction something that lasts more than just a few moments? Why is it so short-lived? So there's much a person can derive just from the design. But the fact that God commands Adam and Eve to multiply means that it is his will to do it. So a person has to look at what we have, the information we have from God, and make a full a decision based on all the facts. So, yes, a person can just look at one verse and say, well, worse than death is the drive, so therefore don't even engage in it. Well, that's not going to be good. So, intelligence has to come in, and a person has to explore and see what else is written on it, and just in terms of understanding the design of it as well. Okay. I mean, there's even an obligation in the Torah that the man has to please his wife. And it also talks about it, I think in the Mishnah, it talks about how often, it depends on what type of career that the person is in. So there's a lot that goes into it. Like anything, it's God's creation, so therefore there's great wisdom involved. You see, that is an interesting thing. It is something which we might do, is to go to the extreme. But we have to be on guard for that as well, because that too is an emotion. Why are we doing that? Why are we saying, well, we might as well just completely abstain? But where does that come from? That type of response is is something which is generated from another part of our being, and that, that happens so much. I mean, you see that you see in the Jewish world that there's extreme, that people go to one extreme and they start doing things that are not even part of the Torah. Beards and black and white clothing alone, and you have that in other religions too. You have extremism. You have monks. You have people isolate themselves. But that's not, that's an emotion too. That's why God knows an emotion, and that's why God wrote in the Torah, don't add on to the Torah and don't subtract from the Torah. Why did God have to say don't add and don't subtract? Those are actually part of the 613 commands. Don't add means God knows very well that there's the over-religious emotion. But don't add because you're wiser than God, that you know that you should do more than what the Torah tells you. Don't subtract. That's a person who wants a life of leisure. He wants to be conservative, reform. Oh, we don't need this law anymore. We don't need that law. We can change it. We can make it easier. So God knows both. He created them. Okay. And my mom, he says it too. He talks about how the person should really be equidistant from both extremes of any emotional spectrum. A person shouldn't be too morbid and he shouldn't be too giddy. There should be a certain in-between, because when you give in to the pole, when you give in to the extreme end of either emotional spectrum, whether a person's a very big spendthrift, he spends all his money, or a person doesn't spend a penny. Right? That's like another thing in terms of the attachment to money. They can be overly attached or very little attached. Or it could be the amount of attachment to love. It could be too much. The guy's just too much romantic and he'll kill himself for a woman. Or a person who just is so cold. So the attachments could be of the highest degree or the lowest degree. Or like Rabbi Chaid explained, really you should be in the middle. Because when you're in the middle, between the two extremes, so it's like when you have two magnets on the table and you put a ball bearing in between the two of them. If you put it right smack into the middle, the ball won't move because the pull is equal from both sides. And therefore, the strength of either magnet is not going to have any expression. The ball will be unfazed. And the person is basically the ball. So if he's unfazed by any emotional pull, then he's now freest to live in line with his intelligence, because now there's no emotional pull on him. If you move the ball a little bit to one side or the other side, so now the ball is going to race towards the magnet and then stick to it, and then the person's going to be too attached to that emotion, and he won't have energies free to be involved in wisdom. So that's why in all areas, the person should work on being in between, except for two, Maimonides says, anger and ego. Because anger is really something which is akin to idolatry. And again, Rabbi Shade explained that why is anger akin to idolatry? Because idolatry is where you're saying that this piece of wood that I cut from a tree and made into an idol, that now controls the world, or some part of the world. So it's a complete fabrication. That's not reality. Same thing with anger. Anger is a response to something which you did not want to happen. But if it happened already, you can't change history. So anger is really a foolish type of involvement. It should only be used when you're trying to educate children or students. So you feign a certain anger to show how much something means to you, and they pick up on it if you can't express it to them intelligently. So anger is one, and ego is the other one the person should never be involved in. Both in anger and ego, the person should go to the opposite extreme, Maimonides says. Ego also, because ego, you're putting yourself as the focus, when really life, the focus is God. But for all other emotional spectrums, we're best off being in the middle. And that takes a certain amount of management and training, control, but intelligence and understanding. And that's, again, I believe what King Solomon is going to be saying in the next verse, 26, when he says, see, this I have found, says Koheles, one-to-one, to find out the calculation. What does it mean, one-to-one, to find out the calculation? Let's see. Maybe we'll leave this for next week. So I didn't really prepare that yet, but I think I saw that in one of the commentaries. It means the wisdom, when you analyze one thing as opposed to the other, that will help the person move towards the right path, because God designed us in a way where we will be more attached to truth than to falsehood. And we see that. People don't lie to themselves. But a person could justify if he gets too involved in emotions. So therefore, we have to be so careful not to let the emotions overtake us, to be free from the emotions. And there are certain times when we're supposed to be. The holidays, we have to drink wine and eat meat. We're supposed to engage because that is part of us. And there are obligations to our spouses sexually. And the Torah even says, when you eat meat, it should be when you have a desire. That's when you should eat meat, meaning that shouldn't be that you're always going after the most delicious food all the time. Eating should also be where you're tempering your appetite, because the eating and the sexual are the two strongest drives. If we keep those in check, and that's why the laws of kosher are so important, so if we keep those in check, then the two major drives are now under a person's control, and his mind, again, is now free to make rational decisions in his life. But you can't do that. You can't decide rationally when you're too passionate about something, when you're too attached to the emotional drives. Okay, let me see if there's any questions or comments.
I think we're good here.
Right. Thank you.
Sure. Okay, so maybe we'll leave the next verse for next week, so this way I'll have time to look it over. And you should look it over also. Take a look, see the commentaries. So it's 7:26 when we'll pick up with next Sunday. And we'll see now how he proceeds in terms of this path. But you see how he's continuing on a certain pattern, a certain thought. So it's not just isolated verses here. We have to see the context and to see where he's going with it. All right, so we'll pick up next week. And any questions or anything during the week, feel free to be in touch. Doesn't have to be on this topic either.
All right, thanks, Rabbi. Have a good week.
You too. Have a good week, everybody.